I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Stuart Ashman. He's director of the Museum of Latin American Art in Long Beach, California. He's former Cabinet Secretary of Cultural Affairs here in New Mexico. And he has written the essay in the new book, Jarlistas Cubanos. It's a book of photographs by Gunta Maya, Tony Gay, and Kurt Zubler. And Gunta Maya and Stuart Ashman will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Monday at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's good to talk to you again.
So you grew up in Cuba, and your father had a Harley Davidson motorcycle and is prominently featured at the beginning of this book. I mean, we've seen endless photographs of the 1950s automobiles in Cuba, but were there many Harley Davidson motorcycles?
Well, you know, at one point there were probably a couple of thousand of them. There was a Harley dealer in Havana. And, you know, during World War II, there was a lot of scarcity of metal and rubber and so on all over the Western Hemisphere. And my father convinced my mother that it would be easier to get two tires than four. So they bought a Harley, and that's what they used as their transportation for a number of years. But, you know, he was quite an enthusiast. He was a member of the Havana Harley Davidson Club and had great little stories to tell about all of their outings.
Now, there have been no Harley dealers or parts stores in Cuba for over five decades, and yet some people are managing to keep these motorcycles running. How do they do it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, everybody knows about the magic of the old 50s American Cuban cars. And I say American Cuban cars because they've really become Cuban cars, and the same is true of the motorcycles. You know, they revered them as icons of a bygone era. They admire, you know, American culture and everything that goes with it, including Harleys, which are, you know, a great symbol of, you know, the open road and freedom and all of that. So they managed to figure them out. There are some people that, you know, were mechanics, and they pass on the knowledge. You know, basically, they're very simple machines in some way. It's just, you know, when the metal wears out, you got to figure out a way of making it happen. So they have machine shops. Sometimes they adapt parts from Russian vehicles and keep them running. They are committed to keeping them as original as possible. So whenever whenever the opportunity comes up for somebody to bring them apart from Mexico or even the United States, they're happy to have that.
Did you meet the people featured in the book, mostly men, who are lovingly tending their Harleys? I mean, the book is organized person by person, sort of portraits of each of these people.
Yeah, we did. Gunther and I had a book signing, a launch of the book in Havana at the National Museum, and about 15 or 18 of the Harleystas came with their families. And so I got to meet them, and, you know, they signed a series of books. So there were like six books that were signed by everybody. And I got one, and Gunther got one, and the director of the museum got one, and so on. So, Adolfo Prieto was there. He's the leader of the LAMA, Latin American Motorcycle Association, which has a chapter in Havana. There's actually another group that also use the name Harleystas, but they are not in the book because this book really focused on the group of people that Gunther had met when he went there and hooked up with Prieto and those people. But there's probably around 150, between 100 and 200 motorcycles operating, Harley-Davidson motorcycles operating in Cuba right now.
Amazing. And one of the guys in the book is, what is it, Che Guevara's son?
Yeah, it's Ernesto Guevara Jr. He's the youngest son. I think Che had four kids, and he's the youngest son. And he's got a nice bike. Looks like it's, I mean, from the picture, I didn't see it in the flesh. He didn't come to the book signing, unfortunately. It looks like it's in pretty good shape in the photograph. I mean, I imagine he has some connection with government still because of his family name and so on. I mean, your father's a national hero. I'm certain that there's some privilege to that. But, you know, for the most part, these people are making sacrifices to keep their bikes running. Not unlike many young and even older Hispanic folks in northern New Mexico, you know, who have a 49 Chevy that they've had for 40 years and it belonged to their dad and they're restoring it and they want to, you know, every time they get an extra $100, they do something else to it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, how is Cuban motorcycle culture similar to or different from American motorcycle culture or motorcycle culture anyplace else?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that makes it very different is the cost of fuel and operating the bike when compared to income. So you're really not going to be using the bike on an everyday basis unless you're generating some income from that bike. So they really become very special, almost ceremonial vehicles that, you know, you take out on Mother's Day and other times like that, somebody's wedding. So in that respect, there's a difference. But, you know, contemporary motorcycle culture in the United States is pretty varied. I mean, it's no longer the Marlon Brando Wild Ones that we imagined or, you know, Hell's Angels that people were terrified of, I guess, in the 60s and 70s. But because it's mostly family people, and in the United States, I think people, I mean, Harley had an explosion of interest in the 90s, from the 90s forward. They sort of reinvented themselves, and, you know, lawyers and doctors had Harleys to ride on the weekends. And in that respect, it's parallel because, you know, you're proud of your bike and you take it out the same way you would your yacht, you know. I think that's how it's parallel. How it's different, I think, is that if you have a Harley with a sidecar, you might use that as a taxi in Cuba, or if you have one with a trike with a trunk, it might be a delivery vehicle, and you won't see that so much in the United States.
Right, right. It's a wonderful book. The texts throughout the book are in English, Spanish, and German, because, of course, Günther Meyer is from Germany. And there's not only the terrific photographs that he took, but also some vintage photographs and amazing motorcycle pictures, but also people's families and some very nice dogs and just great pictures of Cuba and the sense of what Cuba looks like today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and, you know, another photographer that was involved in the book is Tony Gay. There were three photographers. Günther was basically the designer and the main photographer, and these other two guys went with him to Cuba. And Tony is of particular interest because Tony was my next-door neighbor in graduate school in the 70s. And, you know, Günther put us back together because I hadn't talked to him since the 70s when we were very close friends. And unfortunately, 2 days after the book went to press, he had a heart attack and died, so he didn't get to participate in any of the celebrations and so on. He took some great photographs as well.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and you and Günther Meyer will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Monday at 6 in the evening, this coming Monday. The book is called Harlistas Cubanos, and Stuart Ashman is director of the Museum of Latin American Art in California, former cabinet secretary of cultural affairs here in New Mexico, and wrote the essay in the book. Thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. I look forward to seeing you soon.
I'd like now to welcome Demetria Martinez. She is a fiction writer, a nonfiction writer. She's author of the new novella, The Block Captain's Daughter, and she will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's talk about your book, this novella. It's a kind of a set of intersecting stories about people living in Albuquerque, various couples, gay and straight. One of the couples is about to give birth, and she's writing letters to her unborn child. It's, among other things, kind of a portrait of Albuquerque, of New Mexico at this moment. What are the roots of these stories? Is it based in some ways in real life?
Yeah, I have always been intrigued as a writer by the lives of activists. And I would say the book is really a celebration of activist lives. They're not just their politics, but their dreams, their foibles, their love affairs, and in particular their spirituality and how that gives rise to what they do. And so the book kind of touches on all of those themes. And my six Latino characters come from different backgrounds, including two Chicanas who've lived in New Mexico since time immemorial.
You have been an activist also all of your life, and I was going to ask you just that, how your own activist work and your writing kind of relate to each other.
Yeah, I was, you may recall, I guess it's been 25 years now, I was charged with conspiracy against the U.S. government in connection with smuggling Salvadoran refugees into the United States. I was covering what was called the sanctuary movement and was in the end found not guilty on First Amendment grounds. I was a freedom of the press. But that was an opportunity to learn a great deal about activists and what drove them. I mean, I got a chance to see U.S. citizens who risked everything to work with refugees who were coming north to help them, to aid them clandestinely, to transport them and house them and feed them and move them on if necessary to Canada. So that gave me my first really hard look at what it could mean to be an activist, the risks you take, but also the sense of purpose that can infuse one's life by undertaking that kind of commitment and being part of those kinds of communities.
There's also in the book a theme of cultural mixing and cultural loss. And, you know, you have the white guy character who speaks better Spanish than his Chicana partner. And this is really, to me, it's part of the larger narrative of New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm laughing because you picked out one of my favorite characters, poor Peter, a transplant to New Mexico, an Anglo, and the woman he's fallen in love with, Corey, who can't speak Spanish. And, of course, he's fluent in four languages. And so they're really typical, I think, of many New Mexicans. I know Corey's typical of my generation. If you don't mind, I'd love to read two paragraphs that I think kind of encapsulate what you're talking about. This is Peter, in Peter's voice. He's asking, Corey, I take it your people have been here for a while. I say, my great-great-great-grandparents lived in what was then New Spain, which would later become Mexico, then a U.S. territory, and then the U.S. of A. We've been on this land for centuries, and when you take into account that we're mestizos, descendants not only of Hispanos, but Native Americans, well, the indigenous origin stories tell us we've been here since the beginning of time. I have a feeling Corey's done this a lot, ticking off her genealogy to impress men like me. That's the thing with these New Mexico women. They can make you feel like a lightweight, with no history to pin you to the earth. They can drive you crazy with desire, too. I imagine making love to her. I picture her on top of me, her weight holding me down, bringing an end to my wanderings, my loneliness. Corey, a kendo practitioner who can cut a man to pieces in three places, maybe my only hope.
And this is from the book The Block Captain's Daughter by Demetria Martinez. And, I mean, this character, Peter, is not only a transplant to New Mexico, but he's also adopted and doesn't really know who his birth family is, and that's kind of a big set of questions for him.
Right, right. And, you know, when it comes to New Mexico and meet so many people who are so deeply rooted, like Corey, it just brings that pain even more to the surface, that he was never told about his history. You know, he talks about forgiving his mother for choosing not to raise him, but never being able to forgive her for not giving him a family tree. So that's what is really the deepest source of his pain. But in New Mexico, with his friends, he does find a community, really a family of activists who take him in.
Yeah, and it also, I mean, to me, as I was reading through this book, I thought, you know, there's a lot of talk about roots, but cultures change, and this woman, Cori Socorro, doesn't even really speak Spanish, and she's trying to learn Spanish, and that root on some level has been cut, and she's studying some Japanese form of martial arts, and I mean, we're in such a state of mixing and change that it sort of makes you question what it is to be rooted, how important it is, what else is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's language, and then it's so much more. I mean, you know, for me to be a Chicana has been about recovering the language, but it's also about my ties to this land. Again, having been here for my family being here for centuries, but I also think it's about political alliances. You know, who is it that you choose to align yourself with politically? What kind of battles, you know, are you going to fight? Right now I'm working with Los Jardines Institute in Albuquerque, South Valley, and we're a community garden. Our goal is to get organic food out to people in the area who can't afford it. We also do policy work in the area of environmental racism, and we have an underground library with the books that were banned in Tucson, and we have a banned book club. So I think my choice to be involved with a primarily Chicana community is another way that I know who I am, that this is the way I'm, you know, part of the culture. It's who my community is and what I'm giving to that community.
Demetria Martinez is author of the new novella, The Block Captain's Daughter. And once again, she will be speaking tonight, Thursday, at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore right here in Santa Fe. And her website is DemetriaMartinez.com, which I will link to on my podcast site, SantaFeRadioCafe.org. Demetria, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And by the way, the book is a finalist for an international award. What is that? Tell us about that, Demetria.
Yes, the award is called an International Latino Book Award. They offer it in different categories, and Block Captain is a finalist in the category of fiction.
Well, congratulations on that, and we look forward to seeing you tonight. We're talking today to Linda Montano, whose exhibition, Linda Mary Montano, Always Creative, is at Site Santa Fe. We spoke recently. We did an interview not too long ago on the radio when the exhibition opened. And now, at Linda's request, we are doing something a little bit unusual, which is she has asked to interview me. So welcome, Linda, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. And asking you to be interviewed is in keeping with the theme of the show at Site Santa Fe, which is me, you, meaning I did this to cure that, and here's a little recipe as to how you can take what I did and align it with your needs and see how it fits your life. So, that being said, let's start with as early as possible. Tell me about you.
Where do you want me to start?
Go way back.
I mean, the hills of Sicily before I was born.
Why not?
When, let's see, my grandfather came from a little town in the interior of Sicily, which was Greek, which I longed to go to, but I haven't been there since I was a baby. And my grandmother came from a coastal town in Sicily. They met in New York City. They both worked, I guess, in what would now be called sweatshops, but they ended up doing kind of the American dream, and my grandfather made a company or a shop, I guess you would call it, called Imperial Pants, and they had what would be considered a very nice life by almost any standards, and so I grew up in a kind of Sicilian-American atmosphere. My dad was the first person in his family to go to college, and he ended up being quite a distinguished scholar and had some very wonderful mentors who loved him and from whom he learned, and he taught me what he learned from them, and he was a historian and ended up teaching Italian language and literature and history and art history at Vassar College. So I grew up as a college brat in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Wow. Incredible. And your mom?
Well, my mom is from Germany, and she lives next door to me here in Santa Fe. She had quite a journey because when she was a child, Hitler came to power, and it was hard for everybody, and it was, of course, hardest for the people who, Jews and non-Jews, who were tortured and killed, and but it was also not really that great for everybody else either in Germany, and she was in Dresden during the bombings, although they were slightly outside of the center of town, so their house escaped being hit, and I actually went there for her 50th high school reunion. We went to Dresden and saw where she grew up, and she has lived, despite the horrors of war that everybody in Europe went through in the 1940s, she lived a kind of remarkably charmed life, and after the war escaped from the Soviet zone, as did everybody else in her family, and then went to Frankfurt, and then eventually came to the United States, worked for an American company and came to the United States, met my father a month or two after she got here, fell in love. He spoke fluent German, strangely enough. They got married and then tried for quite a long time to have me, and eventually did so.
And you said also she taught.
She was also a college professor. They both got their PhDs, and they both taught at different colleges. She taught at Bard College and then eventually at Colgate University.
What did she teach?
She taught German.
Oh. What was it like growing up on these university campuses?
It was really free. When I look at the way I see children growing up now, where for whatever reason our society is so fearful, and I was just talking to my neighbor whose son isn't allowed to leave his elementary school without parental supervision. We walked to school. I feel like an old timer. We walked to school, but we did, or we took the school bus. There was no parental supervision of any kind, and so, I mean, you grow up on a college campus in the 1960s and 70s, and you have a couple of thousand of acres of essentially your playground. And we just had run of the whole campus, and I ran around with my little friends and, you know, looked at ponds and grass and flowers and nature and sledded and skated on the pond when it froze. And I guess probably if I were to think about it, which I haven't done lately, some academic pressure to succeed on all the faculty kids, but it also wasn't very hard. So we all did well in school and pretty much enjoyed it. Especially, I mean, not maybe so much the social aspects, but I pretty much liked school and learning and reading and things like that. So I got out alive.
What kind of food did you eat as a child?
Hamburgers and hot dogs, canned baked beans, things like that were our daily diet. But then wonderful fruits and vegetables in the summer that were fresh, and we definitely ate great Italian food on holidays down in New York City where my grandparents were, and a very large extended family of aunts and uncles and cousins, and they had antipasto first, which was salamis and hams and things like that and olives, and by the time you got done with the first course, I was completely full, and then the second, third, fourth, and fifth courses came. And after that, they cleared the table, put on a green cloth, and played poker for the rest of the night.
Incredible. The atmosphere. Did you go from Vassar to Bard? Did you live at both places?
I did. My parents separated when I was about 10, and so I went upstate, just I mean, it's only 45 minutes away, so both are along the Hudson River in New York State. And so I just went up the river and switched to the local school there and then got to know the Bard campus and was kind of hazed by the other kids for the first year and then accepted after that. When people talk about bullying now, I understand what they're talking about. It wasn't really that great. But, you know, faculty kids, I guess, are as nice or unnice as anybody else in the world.
Hmm. How did you make peace with the bullying? How did you incorporate that into a healing for yourself?
At the time, I didn't. I retreated into books and puzzles. I was a great fan of puzzles. And cried and felt bad and wrote in my diary. And actually, they would steal my diary, and I wrote in code, and then they tried to steal my code, but I was smart enough not to let that happen.
And they who's they?
There was one sort of ringleader and her minions.
Hmm. So in a way, you're preened and prepared for a life of great intellectual fecundity from an early age, mentoring with your parents and these university campuses and probably lots of lectures and concerts and symphonies and visiting lectures. And what happened then after Bard?
Well, I mean, it wasn't as much of that as you think. The kids, we acted like kind of average mainstream Americans a lot too. We just watched sitcoms of the time and ran around outside, but we did listen to classical music in the house, but I wasn't really taken to all that many concerts. The great thing that, one of the wonderful things my mother did for me that I'm eternally grateful for is she had a subscription to the New York City Ballet, and she went 8 times a year, and eventually she started taking me along. And I was also studying ballet at the time, and it made a really profound impression on me watching that particular company and the dances they did and the music that they were dancing to, Stravinsky and Philip Glass and Bach and so many others. And so that was awesome for me. But I didn't go to that many lectures, and I think the intellectual fecundity part that I was exposed to the extent that I was get-togethers in the house. And in those days, everybody drank like a fish, so they eventually ended up in major kind of cocktail parties that evolved into eating, drinking, dancing on the coffee table, and my father would get out his accordion and his banjo and his mandolin, and everybody would play and sing. And so the conversation ended up in basically major big parties.
Mm. I'm seeing your life as a movie, an incredible movie. And so would you go back and forth between your mother's Bard and Vassar?
Yeah, and I spent weekends with my father and then weekdays going to public school at Bard in Red Hook, New York, where my mother lived.
And college?
Well, at a certain point, my mother remarried to a man who was also a college professor, and he'd gone into administration, and he was at Yale. We moved over there, and I went to high school in New Haven, Connecticut, and then ended up going to Yale for college. So I was in New Haven for 8 years, which, if I had to do it over again, I don't know that I would do either one, because it's not a very hospitable or friendly city or place in many ways. And it's so embarrassing to say this, because despite the tremendous and beautiful privilege of being able to go to such an important and prestigious school, it was a kind of, at least my experience of it was a kind of intellectual atmosphere in which there really wasn't very much place for heart or exploration or kind of creative thinking. I mean, if you were already oriented that way, you might find your subculture, but that wasn't cultivated there. So I had a hard time finding my way there. Never really did, but
so
I survived.
It's kind of a intellectual bullying in a sense.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
No, okay.
I would say it's...
I'll back down on that one.
I mean, for a lot of people, it's fantastic. Especially if you already know what you want to do. I remember when I was a freshman, there was a girl there who was 18 going on 40, and she was a playwright and a play director, and she was always busy, and she was very, I mean, she seemed, I don't know whatever happened to her, but she seemed very distinguished and very confident, and she did plays and directed plays and wrote plays, and there she was, and I was trying to figure out how to talk to people and how to write a paper and how to get to the dining hall.
We chatted a bit, and Salsa came into the picture, and an incredible professor who freed you. But first, I think it was the professor who freed you, the art historian. And
oh, yeah. I was an art history major. And one summer, I had an internship at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And they were putting together an exhibition of early 20th century American painting, including actually a lot of Georgia O'Keeffe paintings and Arthur Dove and Marsden Hartley and people like that. And it was fantastic. It was really interesting. And I was, I guess, a reasonably good intern, but I made real mistakes that nobody should make. And I wasn't very good at it. And I wasn't very good at my major. But this curator who I worked for, and who was a wonderful man and who is still my friend, at the end of the, he really liked me, and he took me under his wing and made me almost kind of like part of his family. And at the end of the summer, he, in the car, very casually said to me, "Mary Charlotte, don't be an art historian." And I felt kind of bad because he was basically saying, you really kind of suck at this, but he was right. And so I didn't, and it saved me years and years of going to graduate school and failing. So I just let it go and graduated and realized at that time when I graduated, which was the 1980s, that I had no idea who I was or where I was going or what I wanted to do, and that I had been kind of inculcated with some really beautiful and good things from my family and the atmosphere in which I grew up, but also some really bad things that had to do with a kind of attitude about hierarchy, you know? Yale University being on the top of some kind of phony baloney hierarchy. And I knew I didn't believe it, and I knew it had to be replaced, but I didn't know what it would be replaced with exactly. So I just decided that I would move to some city, get a job, and just begin to figure out what and who I wanted to be. And I knew it wasn't that, what would you call, prestigious liberal art university model. I knew it wasn't that.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, you become this performance artist of life. And what was the first step of the journey of finding yourself?
I love it. Performance artist of life. I mean, I think the kind of work that you do and the connection of art and life, I think, was such a powerful idea. I came across your work around that time or shortly thereafter in the 1980s. And I realized even then that there is a kind of, like, there's this thing that happens when a good writer sits down to write a novel. And if she is in the flow with her characters, the characters come to her and she starts basically giving them space to act, and she can't really tell them what to do. They just do what they're going to do. And it's as if they have a kind of DNA or life path and life destiny. And I feel like most of us who have, I mean, I don't know what it's like for people who are in terrible conflict zones where it's just about survival. But if you're a few steps ahead of that and it's about more than just survival and you have the opportunity to live and make choices, I think, at least the way I see it, is your life has a kind of inner DNA or destiny. And if you let it happen instead of trying to just direct it all the time, then really interesting things begin to happen. And so that's what I did. So, I mean, I did all sorts of things that I don't really practice or even have that much regard for right now. But in those days...
But those are really, really important steps in this journey. And I wanted, inquiring minds want to know each one.
Oh, no. See, this is what I was afraid of. You ask me things that I don't want to tell anybody. Oh, I mean, we did. I found people who did, I mean, Wiccan rituals under the full moon and kinds of hypnosis and therapy. I guess a lot of what you might call New Agey stuff and spiritual stuff. And I did a ton of writing and some past life regressions. I have hundreds of diaries. She's giving me the thumbs up sign. Thank you. And I had an interesting experience. I always lived on the cheap and got into the habit of figuring out how you can live on really very little money. But there was this one moment where I was living in a housemate situation with four or five people in the house, and I had the smallest room in the house and was paying very little rent, and I felt very crowded. It was one of those things, everyone had futons in those days, and the futon took up the whole room, and I wanted a desk, and I wanted a lamp, and I wanted just things to make me feel like I had some semi-civilized life. And I found myself rather obsessive about those things, and where was I going to put them because they didn't fit in my room. And then I got the idea to take an art course at the Massachusetts College of Art, and it was an animation course. So I learned to do, again, in those days it was cell animation. You would draw on these clear sheets of plastic and film one after the other, and your little lobster would move across the bottom of the sea or whatever you were animating. And as soon as I started doing art, I didn't want anything anymore. I didn't want the desk. I didn't want the lamp. I just wanted to do those drawings. And that was a really big life lesson for me. And then I did Vipassana meditation, and I went on one of those 10-day silent retreat courses. And that completely changed my life and rewired my brain. I mean, I think quite literally that stuff does rewire your brain. And although I have gotten unhappy or angry or depressed many times since then, never to the extent that it was like before that.
I see you as absolutely curious, your vibrational frequency or whatever. You are a woman of being curious as an art form. And you had mentioned something about great books class.
St. John's.
Yeah, that fascinated me.
Well, so what happened was I moved to Boston and did all these crazy things and had a job and did that for several years and then had another job and did that for several years. And at a certain point, one was in the for-profit world and one was in the nonprofit arts world. And I liked them both. The arts one was more interesting. And that was actually where I learned that artists are the most resourceful and efficient people in the world. You give an artist $100 and they can do a performance. You put $100 into a startup venture capital business and it's gone before the first receptionist sneezes. Anyway, after working in those places for a while and 9 to 5 and the office life and everything, I got sort of antsy because I realized I hadn't really read a book for a while or I hadn't really used my mind, and I had a lot of thoughts, but I didn't know what to do with them, and I didn't have conversations going with people. Now it's all I do is every day I come in here and converse with people. It's such a privilege and amazing. But anyway, and I thought, what am I going to do? And I had this friend who's still my friend who was about a half a generation older than I, and she had gone, and she'd really lived the 60s and the whole sex and drugs and rock and roll and craziness. And she had ended up in Santa Fe and had gone to St. John's College and had become a school teacher and lived here for some years. And she said, oh, why don't you go out to St. John's? It's a terrific program. And so that was all it took. And I applied and I went that summer and had an amazing, very contemplative, quiet summer in which, I mean, at St. John's, there is this program where you read the so-called great books, and I think I was at the height of my angry feminist stage at that point, and I feel sorry for the tutors that I had at St. John's who had to listen to me ragging on Plato and everything, but, you know, it was with reason. But anyway, but it was also a very contemplative summer, and I would take my books to the top of Monte Sol and listen to the lizards and the wind and read up there and think about things and think slowly and make notes. And it was a beautiful time. And I remember on the first day of St. John's, they put you in these little rooms. You live on campus, and each room is like a little white monastic cell with nothing, a bed and a desk and a closet and just enough and no more. And then everybody dines together. And I remember looking at the list and thinking, I don't know any of these people, but I will, by the end of the summer, know them all. And I bet one of them will remain my friend. And that is exactly what happened. A few of them, and one, a couple in particular, have become lifelong friends.
Incredible. So then the other aspects, so you have body, mind, and spirit, and mind, you did the great books, but I remember from our talk something about body and salsa and spirit and Cuba.
Well, so what happened was, that was, I guess, the late 80s, early 90s or so, and I went back to Boston, and after one day back in my job, I realized I don't want to live in a big, noisy, horrible city that is, again, characterized by that kind of hierarchy that I rejected and that I don't believe in and really never did. And then I just thought, well, let me just move out to Santa Fe. So the following June, I just sold everything I had and put the rest in my old car and drove out here, which was also so freeing. I mean, you leave the East Coast behind in a car. It's like the American archetype of road trip. And landed here, did another summer at St. John's, ended up doing several summers and getting my master's degree here. And then moved into a wonderful little super cheap apartment that I lived in for 8 years. And after about a year there, I turned on the radio on a Friday night at 7 o'clock, and All Things Considered was just finishing, and Salsa Sabrosa came on. And this salsa music, which I don't think I'd ever really heard before, or never really kind of considered it or paid attention to it before, it completely took over my life. And I know there are people who have met their husband or wife or true love, and they just took one look at them and they knew. Well, this was how it was with that form of music. I listened to it for 2 minutes and it completely changed everything. And I just became obsessed and started collecting salsa music and learning to dance salsa. And I started going to these salsa dances, and I realized that there were people there who didn't speak English, so I learned Spanish and made friends with a lot of people from immigrant communities, and just had a great time. Salsa dancing, I think, is one of the most delightful, fun, fabulous things you can do. And I think the music, especially Cuban salsa and Cuban sacred and secular music, they are rocket science. I mean, even for people who were born into that culture, they spend their whole life learning that culture, because it's this West African and Spanish and European and American mixture, but the deep West African roots that are in the rhythms and in the language and in the way of life and in the way of thinking and seeing and moving are so profound and beautiful and interesting and fun.
So that led you to Cuba?
Yeah, then I ended up going to... What happened was, I actually got married to somebody who was a wonderful salsa dancer. He was from South America, and he was very gregarious and big personality and big guy and outgoing, and we danced together for years, and then it kind of didn't work out. We're still friends, though, but he went back to his country. So by this time, it was the end of the 90s, and I thought, what am I going to do? Because I've always been his dance partner, and I've always been his sidekick. I've always been like the moon revolving around his warmth, you know, his warm sun kind of thing. And I just really wanted and needed to make it my own. So I signed up for this course where they were teaching music and dance in Havana, and I went there, and then I went back a number of times and just loved it and kind of soaked it up. And it's not that I feel that I belong there, because it's actually a rough place to live, but I feel that that music and that dancing and way of life is the closest I've ever gotten to knowing my own soul.
Wow. And where does the radio come into this picture?
Well, what happened then was I had accumulated such a significant collection of salsa and Latin music CDs that I was listening to, again, the Salsa Sabroso show on KUNM one day, and they were making a call for DJs. And so I thought, oh, let me go down and do that. And I went down on a Sunday to their meeting, the Raices Collective. It's a terrific group of people. And by that Friday, I was on the air. They were training me to DJ. So then I got into salsa DJing, and I DJed at a club called the Paramount, which is no longer there, and also Club Alegria, which is also no longer there. Those were institutions. It's a shame that they left. And an absolutely wonderful band leader named, well, everybody calls him Father Preto because he's actually a Panamanian priest. He's a Catholic priest here in Santa Fe. And a band leader of a salsa group. He played every Friday night at Club Alegria, and sometimes I DJed the breaks there, and mostly I just danced. And that club DJing led to radio. Well, how did it go? I can't remember the chronology. Anyway, club DJing and radio DJ both happened. Then I started working behind the scenes at KSFR doing technical stuff, engineering, and then the job at the Radio Cafe came up, and I applied for it and auditioned for it, and here we are.
Here we are. Incredible. A movie. And who's going to play you? Who do you see?
It's funny. I'm enjoying talking to you, and I don't mind talking about this stuff, but I really prefer to listen to other people than to tell my story.
Well, I'll think of someone. In choosing, how do you choose who to bring to your station and to your wonderful cafe with those incredible people there? How do you choose?
Well, I mean, one thing that happens is that I've been doing it now for 9.5 years, I think. Yeah, about 9.5 years. And a lot of people now know about the show, and so they write to me because everybody wants to have their person on the show or to be on the show, and that's great. It's a community show, and I love, you know, the more voices the better, and the more interesting voices the better. And so basically it's kind of like 100 people are throwing pretty shiny balls at me, and I can catch 5 or 10 of them in a week, and that's who gets on the air. And I do some proactive. I mean, if there's an issue I'm interested in, I'll look for people to talk about that. But I have certain guidelines of things I won't put in. Like, if anybody is stupid, evil, or hostile, they don't get on the air.
Oh, no. You let me on. You let me on.
I don't think you're any of those.
No, I'm not
things.
Evil, but I can be stupid, and I can be hostile.
Well.
But I go to therapy. I work on it, so maybe.
Well, also, that's not what you're putting out into the world. I mean, there are some people who their shtick is belligerent.
Oh, okay. What fascinated me was that as I was leaving your cafe the other day, you said, well, tomorrow is a Maasai warrior, and it was just so beautiful. And so, in a sense, you're doing the great books, but you're doing the great people now, and keeping in line with your parents' vocation as university professors, you've become the professor of enlightening and bringing and exploring and sharing knowledge through the great peoples and via the great books that the great peoples are reading or making or writing. And I'm just seeing a kind of linearity between your childhood and now.
Well, it is interesting. Thank you. I mean, the great thing about doing this is I actually don't have to know almost anything. You know, I can think of what the questions are but not know the answers. And so that's very liberating because I don't have to write a dissertation on anything and never will. But it's also great because, I mean, my parents were both great fans of Western civilization, and I think Western civilization is perfectly nice, but there's a lot of amazing Maasai warriors and Tibetan Buddhists and people from all over the world and native people right here in New Mexico with tremendously different ways of seeing the world that are very important for us to kind of internalize.
Yeah, absolutely. If you were to close your eyes and speak to the sky, what would you like to tell the sky now as we end this?
I think the thing I care about most in the world is finding ways for people to hear each other and get along with each other. I think the cycles of war and conflict and brutality and evil, in which women tend to be kind of the non-participants, they don't want that stuff in the first place, and they get brutalized by it. It's no way to run a world. It's no way to participate in a world. And I sometimes feel like, let's just use an example that's universal. You've got a world in which everybody's singing together. You can't fight because your heart is calm and you are in a group. And the problem is that one of the problems is we don't have institutions that allow us to calm our hearts and be with each other in that way. And we're continually fighting over resources and have been for thousands and thousands of years. And I don't know how to solve it. But if I could talk to the sky and the sky had anything to say about it, I would say, can you please find a way to teach us silly humans to live in a peaceful way with one another?
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Linda Montano. And Linda Montano's show is called Linda Mary Montano, Always Creative, and it's at Site Santa Fe. They are on the web at sitesantafe.org.